The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
The Talmud tells us that what is basic and essential about the Ten Commandments, about the Aseret HaDibrot, is that within them, I find somehow mention, allusion to the rest of the Torah. So now let's take a look at this mitzvah, at this tenth commandment, or as we've discussed before, this tenth opportunity. What is this? First of all, just out of curiosity, what bothers you? And we're not going to get to many of the questions, we only have so much time. We could spend a week on this one too. But what bothers you about this mitzvah? Just out of curiosity.
How do you control your thoughts?
Ooh, right to the meat, Aye, good. What is this mitzvah? How do I fulfill this mitzvah? How do I control thought? So we're going to get back to that, because it's not so simple. But okay. Anything else? Yeah, Steve.
Well, it ends up sort of like ignoring anything that belongs to your neighbor or fellow. I mean, that sort of doesn't narrow things down.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, I can cover this one.
It's like 99% of the advertising business, whoosh, right? Like, what does this mean? Don't want anything in life? Anything else? Yeah?
Does covet mean want?
What does covet mean? Yeah. What does it mean, lachmod, chemed, to desire? What does that mean? Chemda. Anything else?
Is it just your neighbor, or does that include, like, your enemies? And
right, like, can you covet your buddy's wife? Well, that's an interesting one. I never thought of that before.
You covet your enemy's wife.
Your enemy's wife.
Yeah.
Right? Let's assume for the moment, only because that's a very good question, but we're not going to have time within the scope of this class to get into it, that we're talking about neighbor being a very generic term. In other words, pretty much everybody out there. But okay, that's a good question, the usage of, okay, chavercha, what that means. Okay, I'm not going to get into the difference between chaver and rea and shachain. There are a number of different phrases in the Torah. If, as we've said at the beginning of this course of studies, if we look at this Torah as a divine book, if we're reading it from the perspective that's given to me by God, so when God chooses a different adjective, he's got to have a reason for it. Or she's got to have a reason for it, whatever, right? So, that being the case, there must be a difference. Those differences are very powerful and very deep, but we won't get to them now. So that's good. This tells me that after a week, people are starting to notice these things. That's good. Anything else? Now that's very interesting. Very interesting. It's not true that it's just directed at the man, because in fact, is this a positive commandment or a negative commandment? Right? I mean, I've got sort of a positive commandment, let's say prayer, to actually do something, to fulfill something. That's called a mitzvat asei, a mitzvah which involves action. And then I've got negative commandments, a don't, as you will, a mitzvat lo tasei, a don't do mitzvah, such as not eating pig. So when I don't eat pig, it's not like I actually do something, right? Although I make a choice not to eat pork, and sometimes I actually, you know, could theoretically have a piece of pork in my mouth and go, oop, and spit it out. So that would be an action. But that mitzvah is a sort of a desist type of mitzvah. So this mitzvah, you're correct, seems to be a mitzvah which tells me to desist from certain things. And the Talmud tells me that women are obligated in all of the mitzvot lo taseh. There are 10 or 11 mitzvot, I won't get into the details, of the positive nature that are related to time that a woman doesn't have an obligation to fulfill. Although according to many authorities, with the exception of two, she can take upon herself that obligation. And that's a deeper discussion that relates to some of the things we alluded to during lunch. But in that case, this mitzvah is definitely for men and women. And we also have a principle, by the way, that the Ten Commandments apply to men and women. That being the case, then the question is not whether this applies to women, but why it seems to be phrased towards a man. Don't desire your neighbor's wife, what that means. Now I will tell you that there is a very deep thought process involved there, which has a lot to do, I think, with human psychology and with the differences. Not better or worse, but the differences between men and women and their makeup. And it's good that we're different. That's why we look to share our lives together, to complement each other's differences. Again, we will not have the opportunity to get into that, just because you have to choose your topics. But that's a very powerful idea, and very good that you noted that. Yeah, anything else? Okay, so let's have some fun. Lo tachmot. I want to know, until I get to this one, at least it's manageable. You know, some of these mitzvot seem on the surface to be very easy. Don't murder. I don't know. Did anybody have difficulty on the way to class today not to murder? I mean, I will grant you, if you become a driver in Israel, there are certain instances in your life where it's very difficult to control yourself not to murder. But okay. But you don't sort of pat yourself on the back at the end of the day. I didn't actually kill anybody. Okay. And it could be, to be fair, that lo tirtzach refers not only to actual murder, although that is definitely the mitzvah itself, but there are all sorts of murder that we can perpetrate on our fellow human being. Character assassination, for example. Chafetz Chaim says that murder is an allusion to all of the mitzvot that refer to how I treat my fellow human being in terms of speech and slander and everything else. Just as theft is not only theft, but you can steal a person's time, a person's sleep, a person's reputation, etc. But I can live with that. I can deal with that. I can focus on it. But lo tachmot. How do you do that? And I want you to know, my biggest question is the value of this mitzvah. I mean, if I say, don't take your neighbor's wife, that I understand. But of course, I've already got that. That's lo tinaf, don't adulter. Now the Torah goes a stage further. And by the way, I understand very obviously why this is the 10th commandment. I would venture to say, although this isn't simple, that maybe this is the 10th commandment because this is the toughest one. Don't adulter. But that's not enough for me. It's not enough for me that at the end of your life, you didn't adulter. I want to know that you never wanted to adulter. So what is this? Is this a command not to be human? First of all, how on earth can you achieve this mitzvah? How do you prevent yourself from wanting things, number one? Number two, it seems to be that the fact that I want certain things is a good, it's a healthy thing. You know, there's a tremendous Talmudic discussion in the tractate of Avodah Zarah. I believe it's in Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara says that the rabbis, you know, notwithstanding our discussion on idolatry, it's an interesting thing that there was a time when man, when humanity, practiced idolatry quite openly, quite publicly, and on a mass level. Today, you don't find it. If you wanted to find a real idolater, you know, at least in the biblical sense, you'd have to go hunting for it, am I right? So the Talmud is interested in this. What happened to idolatry? So the Talmud tells us a legend in Agarata. Now, whether legends are meant to be literal or allegorical is an interesting debate. It's interesting to note that most of the authorities in the Talmud, we discussed this in our last program, the Vilna Gaon, the Rashbam, the Rambam Maimonides in his introduction to the Mishnah, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, who's the author of the Mesilat Sharim, the Path to the Righteous, many great authorities, believe that Agarata is not meant necessarily to be literal. Or at least that the issue is not whether the stories in the Agarata, in these stories in the Talmud, really happened, but the question is, what am I supposed to learn from them? It's not important to me to know that the story I'm about to tell you actually happened. It's important for me to know what I learned from it. Like Rabbi Aaron's discussion on Shavuot night. It's not important for me to know whether Moshe and the angels had such a discussion with God. It could very well be that they did, and it could very well be that they didn't. That's not the issue. The question is what I learned from it. So the Talmud says, okay, the rabbis got together and they decided, you know, this idolatry stuff, it's getting out of hand. It's destroying the world. It's destroying Judaism. People are getting into all sorts of negative practices. We got to get rid of idolatry. We've been trying to get the Jews to get rid of idolatry for a while. And they decide we've been going about it all the wrong way. We've been trying to get the Jews to destroy idols. No. Let's just destroy the inclination to worship idols. That's what the Talmud says. Let's destroy, in other words, apparently there's a specific inclination to worship idols. That's a different inclination than you have to do everything else. Now what that means again, I don't know, but let's think about it. So the rabbis get together and they actually succeed in trapping this evil inclination, this idolatrous desire, and they destroy it. And that's it. Next morning, all the idol worship sellers, whatever, the idol stores, they're all out of business. They have, you know, slashed prices and half sales. Nobody wants to buy them, so they succeed. So the rabbis, they're not stupid. They get together. This is great. This really worked. So let's destroy the general evil inclination. Let's destroy people's yetzer hara. What is it that makes me walk by a store, want a cheeseburger? What is it that makes me sit at a table and want to slander my fellow human being? Right? I have this desire for whatever, for honor, for power, for joy, for money, whatever it might be. Let's wipe that out. Great idea. So they get together and they destroy the yetzer hara, the evil inclination. Talmud has an unbelievable line. Talmud says the next day, there were no eggs. There were no eggs. Because there was no desire. So there were no roosters that were interested in being with any hens. Now this is the Talmud. It doesn't mean that you should look through the history books and find a particular day that there were no eggs. It means that the Talmud is giving me a very important message. The desire that I have to do negative is not a negative in and of itself. It's a very positive thing. If I channel it properly, if I harness it properly, what do I do with it? I have a desire to have relations. So I can channel it in a positive way. and I can meet someone, and I can create a family, and I can bring people into the world, and I can create life, and that's magnificent. Or I can go to Times Square. Physically, it's the same thing. Spiritually, it's very different. That's what the Talmud is saying. So the Talmud seems to be saying that desire can be a good thing. And I would venture to say that that's very true. If I desire to get ahead in my job, so the ambition that I have to succeed is what makes me do a better job. And by virtue of my doing a better job, the world's a better place. So that's good. So why should I not have that desire? What's wrong with wanting my neighbor's house? If because I want my neighbor's house, I go into my neighbor's house and I blow his head off and I say, ha, now I have a new house. So I can understand how that's bad. And I'm purposely painting this in black and white format. But if, because I want to have my neighbor's house, I decide that I shouldn't spend the rest of my life lying around in bed, but I go out and I go to college and I do a graduate degree and a postgraduate degree and a post-double doc graduate degree and I become a professional and I get a job and I make a living and one day I buy a house. So what's so terrible about that? So I want to understand what's the problem with desire. And then I want to understand, how do I deal with fulfilling this command? How do you fulfill this command? Let's assume that I shouldn't, if my neighbor's wife is walking down the street, grab her, throw her in an alley, and, you know, transgress adultery. Okay, that's simple for me. And let's assume then that that's that commandment. What about not wanting to do that? How do I deal with that? And what if, at the end of my life, I get up to heaven, and God should grant, and I've never stolen, and I've never adultered, and I've never murdered, I've never done all these things, but I spent my life wanting to, on occasion. Is that so terrible? So I want you to know, I'll tell you one perspective on this, and this made sense to me for a long time, and then I'll tell you why I don't buy it, and what makes sense to me now. And I think, by the way, that that's a very important idea in Torah. You don't learn something once, and then you have it. Right? That's math. Torah is a little different. You learn it, and you have it. But then you learn it again, and you realize you didn't have it. And then you have it. And then, of course, you learn it again, and you realize you still don't have it. And then you have it. And that's how you're growing through Torah. So that's okay. So, I used to think that the issue of desire is very simple. That the Torah is giving me a recipe. And the Torah is saying, listen, I've just given you 9 commandments. You shouldn't murder, shouldn't steal, shouldn't adulter, all these things. And you may be scratching your head. How do I avoid adultery? So then the Torah comes along and says, oh, I'll tell you what you do. Don't even want her. Because if you don't want her, then you won't reach adultery. In other words, don't spend your time not actually adultering or not stealing. Spend your time focusing on not wanting what it is that you might come to steal. And that's a tremendously valuable approach. In other words, I'll tell you why that's such a beautiful approach, and then I'll tell you why I don't buy it. But I'll tell you why it's a valuable approach. Think about the concept of theft. What is it that leads to theft? I want something that isn't mine. And of course, you know psychologically, we always want what we can't have. That's just the way it is. You learn with your children, if you want them to want something, get them to think that they can't have it. And then they'll want it, and then you can give it to them. It took me a long time to realize that's a tremendously negative form of education. Tremendously negative. To tell your children you can't have it, and then eventually say, oh, okay. And it's like a game you play with them. That's very negative. Because you're teaching them that what they can't have, they can eventually get. It's not good. But that would seem to be what the Torah is doing, to a certain extent. In other words, if you want to avoid theft, focus on realizing that you shouldn't want what you can't have. By definition, the fact that that watch is yours means that not only can't I grab it from you, but I have to concentrate on not even wanting it. I don't want it. I can't have it. It's ridiculous. Don't waste your energy wanting a $90 million home. You know, I was on a plane, right? I read the best material that I ever have for classes. I read on the plane. I get very tired on the plane. I always come on a plane like everywhere else in life with big ambitions. You know, I bring a few sefarim and I've got all these projects. I'm going to finish this class and that class. And then you know what happens? You're sitting there and there's the airline magazine. So you're just going to briefly look through the airline magazine and then you're going to get to your, you know, whatever, right? But of course it doesn't work that way. So I remember once I read this article. I won't mention his name because I'm not sure if this is Lashon Hara. But there's a big, big star and he loves to collect cars. And he's got like, he's very big. And he loves, he's got like 40 different automobiles. Now, you couldn't, I mean, first of all, he has a chauffeur. So, and he has a limo, and it takes him everywhere he has to go. So I don't know that he actually uses these vehicles, but he has them. So, never mind that I shouldn't go and steal them. That's simple. But they're so removed from the possibility of my having them that if I really wanted those vehicles, the only way I could get them is to steal them. So I should focus on the fact that I shouldn't even want them. They should be out of the realm of my possibility. If a woman is married to someone else, she should be so removed from the possibility of me relating to her that it shouldn't occur to me to want her. And I thought, okay, this makes sense, right? This is tremendous. Because I'm focusing on how to avoid the real mitzvah. But that doesn't make sense to me, and I'll tell you why. Because that's not what the Torah is saying. The Torah isn't telling me that this is some sort of a recipe for avoiding what's really the problem. Because if that was the case, if I reach the end of my life, and I've wanted these things, but I've never done anything about it, so I just missed out on the recipe, but I found my own recipe. And I'm willing to bet that there are a lot of people who want things, but they don't go out and steal them. So now let's get a little deeper. In order to get a little deeper, we have to discuss the Rambam. The Rambam, Maimonides, has an unbelievable line. One of the books that the Rambam, Maimonides, wrote is called the Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed. If I had to suggest to you, first of all, I want you to know, just an aside, this work, we actually discussed this briefly last course, but this work is one of those few books that I would actually say, even if you know Hebrew, is valuable to read in English. Because it was originally written in Arabic. The Rambam wanted it to be read in the vernacular. And unless Hebrew is your mother tongue, that must mean that you're better off reading it in English. Plus, it was first translated into English, into Latin. And one of the major translations, which is probably one of the better translations that we have today in Hebrew, Rav Kapach, is actually partly done from the English. So it may well be that it's better to read it in the English. I didn't know this until I read it in the Hebrew. What are you going to do? But okay, I went back and read it in English. It's true. This is an amazing book. And it deals with all the deep philosophical issues of Judaism. And in the midst of this incredible discussion, the Rambam says, you know, and sometimes you catch the Rambam, and it's almost as if he's tired from all this work, so he kind of like takes a break and leans back, and he starts to muse. And I love those parts of the Moreh Nevuchim. I love when the Rambam does this. He kind of like gives you a break for a minute. He says, you know what the most difficult mitzvah in the Torah is? What's the most difficult mitzvah in the Torah? What's the most difficult mitzvah in the Torah? And when he said this line, I had an opinion. I mean, we do this here at Israelite. What am I trying to find? What is the most difficult thing to discover, to accomplish? That's good. That means you've gotten somewhere if you don't have a ready answer. I'll tell you what I always thought. I always thought the most difficult mitzvah in the Torah is Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord thy God. Because the Rambam, Maimonides, says in the beginning of the Sefer Mitzvot, the Book of Mitzvot, that this means you have an obligation to know that there's a God. So it's one thing if he says, look for God, but that's not what he says. You have to know there's a God. How do you develop a relationship with God to the extent that you actually know that there's a God? So we talked about this a little in the class we had on Anochi, and I discussed it with you. But that's a very difficult mitzvah. That's not what the Rambam says. No, that's easy pie. He says, you know what the most difficult mitzvah in the Torah is? It's a verse, I believe it's in Leviticus and Vayikra. Lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha. You can't hate your brother in your heart. That's a very difficult mitzvah. It doesn't say don't smack your brother. I remember once, I was in the playground with my son, and he was climbing up on the handlebars. Not handlebars, the monkey bars, right? And then he was like coming down the slide, and I'm not sure exactly what he did. I think he pushed another kid out of the way. I know this is hard for you to believe that my son could do such a thing, but yeah. And so I'm sort of witnessing this from afar, and I'm already getting up to walk over to say to Yonatan, listen, you know, it's not the way we behave. Say, I'm sorry, you know, let's talk about it, right? And he's 4 years old. And, you know, but it's normal. A kid's on the slide, you know, he wants to go down the slide. He pushes somebody else out. So, you know, here's an educational opportunity. And before I get a chance to say anything, I assume the parent, quite irate of this other child, right, is already running to the slide, right? And the other child's sitting there crying, and I'm already walking over, right? Picks the child up and starts yelling at Yonatan, at my son. Now I want to tell you something. It's easy to sit here in class and to say, you know, you shouldn't have negative feelings towards your fellow human being. This person is yelling at my son! And then, you know, Yonatan doesn't know quite what to do with this. He's sort of halfway going down the slide, sort of looking in shock at this person yelling at him. Right? When he gets to the bottom of the slide, right, So the parent is still there. And this is all like in an instant. So this person grabs my son's arm. Then he was, I think, 3, right? 3-year-old kid grabs his arm and says, "Now you will say I'm sorry to my son. I don't ever want to see you. What's the matter with you?" Right? Right? So here's the chance to fulfill the mitzvah of lo tirtzach, thou shalt not kill. Right? This is my son. Someone's yelling, grabbing the arm of my son. But that's not what the Torah says. The Torah says, not only am I not allowed to smack this guy, not only am I not allowed to tell him off, I can't hate him. I can't have any negative feelings towards him. How do you do that? And the Rambam says that's the most difficult thing in the world. Somebody comes over to you, God forbid, at the Kotel, because you're trying to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and spits on you. It doesn't say, thou shalt not picketh upeth thy axeth and give him a haircut. That's not what it says. It says, you can't have negative feelings towards that other human being. It's very difficult. Now, don't misunderstand me. This is not the Christian idea of turning the other cheek. If somebody is coming up a hill, and I'm in Lebanon, and they're firing a machine gun, and they're trying to kill me, I don't stand up and say, thou shalt not hate. Come, my brother. No. Right? You blow his head off. And if somebody raises their hand to hit you, then you have every right halachically to defend yourself. That's not what this halacha is. The issue is not what you do. The issue is what you feel. And I remember reading this, and at first it seemed strange, and then I started to think about it. How do you control what you feel? How do you control your emotions? And I want you to know how important, how crucial this is. Because what the Torah is telling me is, if I can't have something, then the desire to have it is a negative. It's something which cannot give me happiness. It cannot bring me pleasure and joy to desire that which I can't have. That's why it doesn't just say lo tachmod. It says lo tachmod, whatever it is you can't have. And there are different types of chemda, of desire. There's the desire for a relationship, eshet reyecha, the wife. There's the desire for acquisition, right? Beit reyecha. There are different types of desires. If I'm desiring something which I can't have, that has to mean that I'm going through a negative process. So I can respect the fact that there's a value in my not desiring this. But how do I do that? So I want to tell you, I want to share with you a personal odyssey. Because in this particular mitzvah, it seems it's not enough to know the mitzvah. Can I actually come up with a system to acquire, to attain this mitzvah? So I became fascinated by this. How do you deal with this? How do you do this? Can you actually reach a stage, you know, to have a goal where you feel you've, I don't know, covered a page in Talmud, to have a desire, you know, when I had a principal when I was in high school. I was in high school, I was in the yeshiva high school. So we had a principal of Nachum Cohen, tremendous Talmud Chacham. So this principal, so he looks around the room and he says, has anybody here been through Shas? Has anybody here been through the entire Talmud? So we look at each other, you know, we're in like 10th or 11th grade. Like, you know, get a life. I mean, the Knicks game is on tonight, right? You know, like we've covered this page and that page and we don't even know it. So he says, well, who wants to finish the Talmud? So we look around the room and, you know, maybe one, you know, the super nerd raises his hand, you know, right? The dweeb. And everybody else is like, yeah, you know, right? So he looks at us, hits his head. He says, Gvalt! He says, you know, it could be that you'll never get through the Talmud. You shouldn't have a desire to want to finish the Talmud. How could you not have that desire? Every Jew should want to go through Talmud once in their lifetime. Had a very powerful impression on me. What do you want in life? And I want to tell you, it hit me when I was learning this Rambam. I was like, I don't know, second year in yeshiva. What a goal this would be. To actually reach a level, to reach a stage in my existence as a human being where I don't hate anybody. Can you reach that goal? And still be a productive person? And how do you go about doing this? So this fascinated me. Rav Yisrael Salanter. Rav Yisrael Salanter was the founder of the Musar movement, which was a movement that felt that people were concentrating so much on how to take apart a page of Talmud, they were losing the value of what the Talmud was supposed to really be teaching me, how to be a better human being. And it focused very much, it didn't, God forbid, drop the issue of studying Talmud and Torah and whatever else, but it spent a lot of time developing character traits as well. Rabbi Saul Salanter used to say, right, it's easier to go through the entire Talmud than to change one character trait. And that's very true. So how do you do this? So I want to give you two perspectives. And for my money, if you leave Israelite and you gain nothing else from any of the classes, what I'm about to share with you now, you walk away with, then you've got a world. Because this, I think, is one of the essences of Torah, of what Torah is supposed to do for me as a human being. The Rambam, in his magnum opus, the Mishneh Torah, right? I shared with you at one point that the Rambam wrote this whole work on halacha, right? On Jewish law, he has an unbelievable set of laws. They're called Hilchot Deot, the laws of character traits. The Rambam says, and it's a very strange thing, what do you mean the laws of character traits? And the Rambam discusses, how do I develop myself as a human being? And the Rambam included this in his halachic system. Because there has to be a system for developing as a human being, just like there is for how to eat in a kosher home. And the Rambam says a tremendous thing. He says, if you want to change a character trait, what you're really looking for, ideally, is the middle road. What many have called the Shvil HaZahav, the golden path. But he says, if you find a character trait that you have difficulty with, the way to reach that middle road is to go to the opposite extreme, so that eventually you'll come back to the middle. Now that's a very dangerous statement, as you can imagine. But I'll give you an example. There was a time in my life where I felt I had to work on my temper. Right? I think it was right after I got out of the army. I'd been in the army for 4.5 years. You can't be in an experience like that and not have a chip on your shoulder. Especially when you're around people, you know, because I had a lot of friends who were Americans, and they were sort of finishing college, and they'd had 4 years of fun. And here I'd come out of experiences in Lebanon and life and death, etc., and you find yourself sort of sitting there wondering, like, what are we talking about here? Like, get real, get a life, find issues. And so I had this all this energy that I had to get rid of. So the Rambam says, you know how you get rid of that? You know how you learn to deal with that? Because I want you to know, having a temper, well, that's something that's a part of us. And it's something HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us. God gives us. So it can't always be negative. Sometimes having a temper can be a very positive thing. I can think of instances in my life, especially under combat conditions, where forcing yourself to get angry can be a very positive thing. But more often than not, it's not a good thing. There are people who never get angry and they have ulcers. So that can't be a good thing either. How do you know when to get angry and when not to get angry? You know, the Torah doesn't say, oh sure, please take my wife, take my house, take everything, I love you. You know, that's not what the Torah is about. So how do you find that middle path? So the Rambam says, if you want to develop that particular character trait, become sickeningly, disgustingly nice. Become so sickeningly, disgustingly nice, right, that people don't know what to do with you. And if you practice becoming nice, if you fake it, as it were, then eventually you'll find the middle path. Okay. Now I want you to know that this works. It's sickening sometimes, but it works. There is a value to this. I could see this. But that wasn't enough for me. So what do you do with that? So I want you to know there's a tremendous idea. There's a verse, there's a pasuk. And the pasuk says, and I think this perspective will allow us to get back to this commandment and decide what the issue here is. Pasuk says, Sur mera va'ase tov. Right? Turn away from evil and do good. Now you know in Jewish history, with the rise of Hasidut, when the Hasidic movement came onto the platform, as it were, of Jewish thought, so there were many who had a real problem with the idea of Hasidut. Hasidic thought originally in the 1700s said basically, don't get too stuck in the word of the Talmud in the Beit Midrash and forget what it means to sing to God, to dance with your fellow man. Now you can imagine that certain traditional systems were a little nervous about this. And it's good that there's a certain hesitancy to change. You know, we're sitting in the yeshiva, and we're learning Torah, and we've been doing it this way for 2,000 years. Comes along someone and says, forget, close the Talmud, let's go dance and sing. So there was a lot of resistance to this. So the movement that was resistant to this was called Mitnagdim. They were sort of negative somehow. They were against it. I always think that it was the Hasidim that called them this name, right? And then there were the Hasidim. So the Mitnagdim, these sort of opponents of Hasidut, of this more emotional perspective, said, what does it mean, sur mira? And by the way, as a background, realize that both of the approaches I'm sharing with you have their legitimacy. But the Mitnagdim said, what do I do? Sur Meira, turn away from evil and do good. So I'm going to spend my time turning away from evil. I'll walk down the street and I'll focus on my Talmudic tractate and don't look at someone else and don't even think about it. And you know what? If you're afraid, you're going to slander, so don't speak. And if you're afraid, you're going to steal, so live in the desert and walk down the street and don't look at it. And God forbid you should look at a woman, you might desire her. That's the way to deal with it. Focus. Avoid evil. Remove it from your existence. Tremendous introspection. The Hasidim came along and said, no. Come on. Don't worry about avoiding evil. Just do good. The evil will take care of itself. That's what they said. Now there's a great depth of thought in that perspective. And don't assume, by the way, that that's the entire thought process of those who were opposed to Hasidut. There's much beauty there. You see, if you spend time removing what's inside of you, and create a vacuum, you have to fill it with something else. Very often people focus on how to remove themselves from something, or how to remove something from them, but because they don't realize they've created a vacuum, they don't spend enough time focusing on what's going to replace it. I'll give you an example. Have you ever met someone who's trying to quit smoking? More often than not, what happens when a person quits smoking is they just get addicted to something else. Right? I have what I call, you know, the Havdalahs, the smoker's Havdalah. Right? You know, Saturday night you have this Havdalah service. So if a person is celebrating Shabbat and chooses not to smoke on Shabbat, right, according to tradition, right? So when Saturday night comes around, so, you know, it's like, you know, as soon as we make Havdalah, we have that service, you can smoke. So I always know when I have a smoker in the group because they're like this during Havdalah, right? So the smoker's Havdalah is much, much quicker. So sometimes you get, you know, a person who says, that's it, this week, I'm not going to smoke. So they don't smoke for a week. So by the end of the week, you know, they're still doing this. You know why? Because they've had 900 cups of coffee. You know, so you break this addiction. You get people are on a diet. So they're not eating, right? So they're smoking. I mean, you know, you have to find the way to break an addiction. What are you going to fill it with? So imagine getting addicted to good. Just to being good. If you're trying to remove what's negative inside of you, you have to decide what you're going to replace it with. Can you fill it with good? Sur Meira, Asay Tov, do good. So now go back to this mitzvah. What does this mean, lo tachmod? What is chemed? What is desire? What does it mean when I desire that which I can't have? See, we make a mistake. And we assume that the things that affect us are the things we have. But the truth is that we are very deeply affected by the things we want. I look at my children. You know, it's like when I ran a yeshiva. So I used to go visit the dorms all the time, schmooze with the guys. I thought, you know, schmooze to talk. I thought if, you know, if I could develop enough of a relationship that they could still respect me as a teacher, and yet I could hang around with them and talk with them, so that'd be a wonderful thing. I learned a tremendous amount about my students from the posters that they put on their walls. Who's on your wall? Now don't get me wrong, you go to Meir Shearim, and you walk into a store there, and they have baseball cards too. But their baseball cards are the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Moshe Feinstein. You know, I'll give you one Moshe Feinstein for two Lubavitcher Rebbes, or vice versa. I guess it depends which end of town you live on, right? I don't know what statistics they have on the back of the card. You know, it's like, what's the earned run Talmudic page? Or, you know, how many chapters of Rambam did they get in a game? I don't know. But there's something to be said about what it is that I want. Do I want to be Michael Jordan? You know, last night, so my somebody gave us, whatever, long story. There's this movie called Space Jam. It's this combination of Walt Disney and Michael Jordan, right? Reb Michal, who was the great hero of American youth, right? So we were in Tel Aviv, whatever, and this is before Pesach, I think, or maybe after Pesach, whatever. We're in Tel Aviv, and we saw this movie, whatever. We had just been with friends for Shabbat in Ranana, and they said it was wonderful. You know, the father went to see this movie, and it was actually something that he enjoyed, his kids enjoyed, whatever. So, this guy was selling it for like nothing. Now, I thought it was in the theaters, so, you know, and I couldn't imagine taking my kids, just not because I have a problem with it, just because to find the time to take your kids to a movie. If I'm going to find the time for 2 hours to spend with my kids, I'm not going to go sit in the room and not talk to them. That just seemed to me silly. I never understood that. But okay, they go to the movie, there, but okay. So, we bought this movie, we figured whatever. I'll be honest with you, the educational value of this movie is not great. Monsters come from outer space, they want to play basketball, and Michael Jordan gets involved. I don't know the whole movie, but that's as much as I chapped on it. So my kids are watching this movie, and I decided after a while, you know, I don't think that this is like, you know, what I, you know, I mean, some movies that my children have, they have The Sound of Music. I think that's a magnificent movie, you know, whatever it might be. Walt Disney in general doesn't have a good track record with me in terms of, you know, sort of educational messages for children, but okay, fine. But I was sitting, three nights ago, and my son couldn't sleep, probably because he slept all afternoon. And I was downstairs, and I was cleaning up the living room for Shabbos, I think it was, and there was a game, a basketball game on. This is the big, you know, the finals, the Utah Jazz and the Chicago Bulls, you know, very important, right? The world is going to be decided based on this. And so I had it sort of on in the background, and I'm cleaning up the living room, whatever. And don't get me wrong, I think that what some of these players can do is an incredible beauty, that you can achieve that level in a sport. But again, the question is what for, but okay. So how do I know I have an issue to deal with? Because my son is sitting there on the sofa, right, sort of falling half asleep, and I'm getting to talk to him, whatever. And all of a sudden he looks up, he goes, Michael. And he's 4 years old. He saw this movie. All of a sudden the star of the movie is like in a basketball game and he can't figure this out. Right? So, you know, I wish my son would recognize Lubavitcher Rebbe like he recognizes Michael Jordan. But right, maybe he's more distinctive, I don't know. But understand what we want is very much a part of who we are. What do I want to be? What do I want to become? Why do I want to have 20 cars? Do I want to have 20 cars because I want to have? Or do I want to have 20 cars because then I can give? Like, I want you to know, since I had a big car accident about 2 years ago, had a great effect on my life. If you have a car accident and you're in a near-death experience, whatever it might be, and it doesn't have an effect on your life, you've missed an incredible opportunity to grow as a human being. So, Baruch Hashem. So it had this effect on me. So since then, one of the effects it has on me is that now I take rides and I don't really do that much driving. Right? So I ride in every day, and it's wonderful. I get to meet people. I talk to a lot of people I wouldn't talk to otherwise. You know, I can read. I can learn in the car there, in the car back, whatever. I ride my bike to work from Gilo. Fine. The one thing that I miss about not having a car is that when you have a car and you drive in to Yerushalayim, so you get to pick up hitchhikers. Right? Because when you leave a ride, people are taking for a ride. You can pick them up. And when you come home, you can pick them up. You can't do that on a bicycle. I haven't found a way to do it on a bicycle. So that means you're missing out on something. What's a car for? Is a car so I can have a car? Or is a car so I can use a car to take me to wherever it is I'm going? But how do I see my world? If the meaning of a relationship is that it allows me to build a world, if my relationship with my wife allows me to have children, to create a family, to make the world a better place, to teach those children Torah, to make them better people so that they can make other people better people, etc., then the idea of wanting someone else's wife would be ridiculous. Right? Because I can't do that with someone else's wife. It's absurd. It's like, for example, there's a halakha. You can't fulfill a mitzvah with an item that's stolen. Ein mitzvah ba'a bidei avera. You can't achieve a mitzvah by doing a transgression, by transgressing a command. So, for example, I get all excited about this whole Sukkot, this Feast of Tabernacles thing. You got the four species, the lemon-looking one, the palm branch, the whole deal. So I'm all excited. I go to Meir Shearim to go buy a set. I find out how much it costs. That's it. My excitement goes out the window, right? Because you can spend a lot of money on these things. But I figure I'm smart, right? Because I learned that the biblical command to fulfill the mitzvah is only on the first day, and the last 6 days is the rabbinic. So I figure, okay. So I go to synagogue. I wait till somebody finishes, and I steal them. Now I've got a great set. I steal the Lubavitcher Rebbe's. I don't know, whoever. Right? That'd be a neat trick today. But you understand. Well, not according to some people. But you understand. Right? I can't do it. I can't do it. Because you can't fulfill a mitzvah. You're not doing anything. You might as well use a piece of cardboard. It's stolen. You can't fulfill the mitzvah. That being the case, I have no desire for someone else's set of four species. Because there's no reason to have a desire for it. Because I can't fulfill a mitzvah with that. It's his. That's a whole different perspective. And so the Torah says, not only shouldn't you do, but you shouldn't even desire to do. And I want to go you a stage further. Because I want you to know that the Torah has this incredible confidence in humanity. Nobody respects us like God respects us. And the Torah says you have the ability not only to control what you do, not only to channel, to harness, to find positive within what you do, you have the ability to control what you think. You can force yourself, you can train yourself to think positively about your fellow human being. And I want you to know there is no more magnificent exercise in life than to look at a given situation, such as what we were discussing at lunch about yesterday morning at the Kotel and that tragic headline in the paper. Can you find positive food for thought, even in that? And that's a challenge. And what this mitzvah is saying, when it says lo tachmod, that you shouldn't desire something that isn't yours, it's issuing you with a challenge. What are you going to do with that thought process if you can't have that negative thought process? The only way to deter a negative thought is to fill your head up with a positive one. That's a tremendous idea. Because it can't be that those negative thought processes don't affect me as a human being. And I want you to know, it's very true. You look today in Western society, I don't know enough about Eastern society, but in Western society, look at what the youth in our society desire. Who are their heroes? Who are their role models? What is the measure of success today in America? And I want you to know, pardon? The dollar. Well, I don't have a definitive answer, because I think it is different in different communities, but I would go so far as to venture that it's very frightening. It's very frightening. Because all the haves are what people want. And very often what people want, they can't have. One of the most important questions you can train your child to ask is, what for? What do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a basketball player. Wonderful. What for? There is no negative answer if it's followed by a what for. If my child ever tells me, you know, there was a magnificent movie. It's called Chariots of Fire. Did you ever see this? Incredible movie. It's a true story from the Olympics of 19, I don't know, anybody know? 13, something like ancient, right? 1936? Oh, okay. 36, 13, you know, there's a three, right? And there's one character in there who is a priest. And he's an incredible runner. And he wants to run. And his wife, who shares with him in the ministry, is terribly upset that he's going to run in the Olympics. He's a man of cloth, a man of God. How is it going to look? And there's one magnificent scene. And he says, you know, he's like a Scotsman. He says, when I run, he says, I run for God. He says, I don't run for me. He says, when I run and I feel the power in my feet and I feel the gift that God's given me, and I see that people see that a man of the cloth is running. And I'm running not for me, but for the glory of God. He says, that's what I was put here for. That's magnificent. That's the definition of Kiddush Hashem, of sanctifying God's name that we spoke about. So if you would say to me, do I want my son to want to be a runner? I don't know. But if that would be why my son or my daughter would want to be a runner, that would be magnificent. When Sandy Koufax chose not to pitch in the World Series on Yom Kippur. What an incredible moment for the relationship between all of humanity and God. It's tremendous. That's all part of what this mitzvah is. What do you want? I've given you now mitzvot. I've given you a Torah. This Torah can teach you what you should want. And what you should want it for. But don't kid yourself. Because the entire process in the Torah is first about letting go of what I shouldn't want. I have to first get out of Egypt before I can come to Sinai. And I have to get the Egypt out of me before I can get to Sinai. Now, it's not, God forbid, for me to define what that Egypt is. I don't know. Everybody has their perceptions. Everybody has their way of relating to that. But that's the challenge. And I will tell you that the Mishnah is full of how to deal with it. And then the very next Mishnah says, Harchek mishachein ra. Distance yourself from an evil or a bad neighbor. So if Cook says, wait a second. If I'm supposed to assume the best about every human being, then how can I ever have an evil neighbor? Doesn't make sense. Right? I'm supposed to assume that this guy, when he walks out of the house in the morning with two machine guns on the way to McDonald's, and then I read the paper that night, I'm supposed to assume that, no, he was just there in case some psycho and wasn't him. I'm supposed to assume that. No. Mishnah says, don't judge the person. Assume the best about the human being. Doesn't mean you can't judge his act. I can look at an action and I can say that action is a negative action. But that doesn't mean that I then have the right to jump one stage further and say that's a negative person. There is no such thing as a negative person. So that's what that means. But because I have the ability to judge an action, I can also look back and say, what is the effect of that action on me? What's the effect of that person's actions living next door to me? And I have the right to assume that it can have a negative effect, and I have to do something about that. So what does this tell me? This tells me that there's a value to processing my thoughts, to attempting to think positively about other human beings. And I want you to know something, it's very interesting. When I train myself to think positively about other human beings, I just naturally stop thinking negatively about them. I don't have to focus my energy on not to think bad thoughts. I just focus my energy on thinking positive thoughts. And I want you to know something else. And this is a longer discussion. But it not only makes me a better human being, it makes me a happier human being. And by virtue of the fact that you become a happier human being, well then people around you become happier. And if people around you become happier, then the people around them become happier. The implications of this mitzvah are incredible when you stop to think about it. And you can actually change the way you think about another human being. And I urge you, try it. Think of a person or an action or a time, now or in the future, when you feel you have a right to think negatively about someone and find a way to think positively. It doesn't mean it should change the way you act. If you disagree with what they're doing, disagree with it. But there's a long cry difference from disagreeing with someone's actions and having a negative opinion of the person. One is destructive to you as well, the other isn't. So that's the idea of lo tachmor. That's what it means. And that's why this is the last of the Ten Commandments. Because this gives purpose and meaning and function to all the other Ten Commandments. It gives me a perception of what this is all for and what I'm supposed to do with it.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.